Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. This week, we'll check back with Sophia Maravill. In past episodes, we've spoken to Sophia and her father, Nick, about the controversy surrounding their seed-saving operation, an educational farm in Potomac, Maryland. And we'll hear the latest on their efforts to save their land from potential development, but that's later in the show. First, we hear from Tom Philpott. Tom Philpott is food and agricultural blogger for Mother Jones. He's co-founder of Maverick Farms, a center for sustainable food education in Valley Cruces, North Carolina. And formerly, he was a columnist and editor for the online environmental journal Grist. And his work on food politics has appeared in Newsweek, Gastronomica, and The Guardian. I started the conversation by asking him about the Farm Bill, which failed to pass Congress this year.
Well, you know, what could very well happen, and it's in a lot of flux right now, but there is a furious effort to get it folded into a fiscal cliff deal, and that could happen in one of two ways. This could happen very soon. It could happen today. It could happen tomorrow, or it could not happen at all. One thing that could happen is that Speaker Boehner and Obama could cut a deal, and they need, according to this ridiculous thing they set up, they need to, you know, cut the deficit and cut significant spending, and they could make a deal that they would have to get passed through both houses of Congress, but they could cut a deal that would essentially write a farm bill with steep cuts. There could be steep cuts to the commodity programs that a lot of people like me complain about, but also steep cuts to conservation programs and other sustainable ag programs that are pretty necessary. So that's one thing that could happen. The other thing that could happen is that the Senate and House Ag Committee people, the people who run those committees, are furiously trying to reconcile the two versions of the bills that are in both of those houses to try to get a completed farm bill to Boehner and Obama ahead of this conversation that would look more like, you know, what the bodies came up with in 2012. But what happened was that the full Senate came together and passed a version of the farm bill and went to the House, and the House Ag Committee passed a version of the farm bill which needed and was different from the Senate version. So the next step was that it would go to the full House, and what happened was it died in the full House. So the House, beyond the Ag Committee, the House never passed the Farm Bill this year, and that's where we are. So what they're trying to do is come together really fast and throw something together, and what they come up with will also probably be really bad. It will probably include pretty severe cuts to food stamps. It will preserve the kind of, you know, subsidies to big ag that I complain about, and will probably steeply cut conservation and other sustainable ag programs. And so we are in this situation of extreme flux and unpredictability. Now, what you said is also correct, that there is a strong chance that all this will fail. In that case, they'll have to come up with a stopgap measure that will buy them some time, that will keep some of the main programs running. Like, you know, the big one is the milk program. Mm-hmm. If we were to reach the new year with no farm bill, then price support and price limitations on milk would fall away. You could see a pretty significant rise in the price of milk. And I kind of doubt that'll happen. I think they'll come up with a stopgap. And so then in that scenario, you know, it's completely up in the air. We'll start from zero. We'll have probably a 9-month or a year extension. And the new sessions, the new, you know, 2013 Congress, will be tasked once again with coming up with the farm bill. And I think the politics will be similar because, you know, we'll have the same situation in the House and the Senate. And, whole, you know, their zeal to cut the budget. Some of them even want to cut farm subsidies, which is controversial because, you know, some of them are from farm states and don't want to cut farm subsidies. The interesting takeaway from the farm bill for 2012 was that this coalition that has made farm bills happen, the kind of farm bills that we're getting now since the 80s, which is, you know, big farm state interests that want to keep subsidies going, urban interests that want to have a, you know, a decent food stamp program, would come together and make a deal and would get these farm bills that, you know, had a decent food stamp provision and then had, you know, these sort of big ag programs. The Tea Party is kind of throwing a wrench into that, you know, refusing to go along with food stamps, which is a really kind of crazy thing given how bad the economy is and how many people are relying on food stamps now because the economy is so bad. You know, some shocking number percentage of children in the United States live in poverty, and it's something like one child in six lives in poverty and with food insecurity. So it would be a really bad time to cut food stamps, and that is the most likely scenario, I think.
When do you think this will all come to a head? Do you think it'll come to a head before the new Congress comes in? Do you think it's going to come to a head before the inauguration? When do you think this will happen?
I don't know. I mean, I keep hearing things that whenever you read a headline that says a fiscal cliff deal is near,
yes,
I think it's pretty sure that there's some kind of farm bill in there. And so
right.
If they make a deal on the fiscal cliff, which, you know, we keep hearing is imminent, and then they kind of pull back on. So I think it's tied up in that. I think if we get a fiscal cliff deal, we'll get some kind of farm bill. Now, they could make a fiscal cliff deal with just a one-year, the one-year extension could be folded into a fiscal cliff deal, and then we'll move back to square one. And so, you know, we're at a period of incredible flux, and I don't think a farm bill has ever, at least in an election year, I don't think that a farm bill has ever not, when a farm bill is up in an election year, it's always passed.
Except for this one.
And this year didn't happen.
It was interesting. When I interviewed Mark Hertzgard on this program, right around the last time you and I spoke, Mark had written a piece saying that he hoped the bill didn't pass because it would give time to have a real debate discussion in the country that we don't have now.
I agree with that. But on the other hand, we kind of always say that. And that's a really hard conversation to have because, you know, unfortunately, these big interests really kind of dominate it. And, you know, we're always, well, I've been writing about the farm bill. I guess the first one that I really dug into was the 2007-2008 one. But, you know, there's always this sense when you get into this topic, you learn the importance of the farm bill, and you see the fact that, you know, we've got a government in this kind of austerity climate that we're in that spends billions of dollars a year supporting farming. And you see the progressive possibilities of that. We could be using that money to reinvest in local food production, regional food production. We have this infrastructure gap in stuff like meat processing and retail that we could be addressing with this money. So you get all this hope, and then you realize that there's this very powerful lobby that controls the conversation, and then there's this very kind of sticky political situation with the fact that it's sort of joined together with food stamps, and you got that hunger, got this coalition of anti-hunger advocates that very understandably want to keep food aid coming, and you see that it's just kind of a mess. And so, you know, I don't know if we're going to get the conversation that we want next year either, but I do agree that it's ridiculous to have farm bills made with such little debate. And there's been very little debate around this farm bill. It was pretty hastily passed through the Senate without much public debate, and it got to the House Ag Committee again without much public scrutiny. And then it dropped like a stone. The House Republican leadership just sort of killed it. Cut off debate, didn't want to talk about it, and it just sank.
So we'll just keep following this and see where this goes. And it'd be interesting to kind of start. Once the holiday ends, we'll see where it is. There's not much we can do between now and then. I guess after we'll see what happens to the fiscal cliff. And I think you're right that when they have these gigantic economic negotiations, you know the farm bill negotiations are hidden within, beneath that, averting the public eye.
Right.
So tell me what things you think for you, before I talk about some things you've just been writing about, which I'm really interested in, what you think are the most significant kind of stories and issues that you've come across in 2012?
The consensus would have to be that the story of the year, beyond the farm bill, the sort of depressing side of the farm bill, the story of the year was the Prop 37 measure in California that we talked about earlier, Mark, the measure that was on the California ballot that would have required the labeling of GMO foods in the state. And it, you know, it became, you know, leading up to the November election, a few weeks before, Michael Pollan, you know, the famous food politics writer, wrote a piece in the New York Times Magazine, you know, basically making it a referendum on the food movement. If this passes, then we know that we have a politicized, powerful food movement that's gaining power. If it doesn't pass, then maybe we don't. And of course, as you know, it didn't pass. And I think just fallout from it, the, you know, the effort to get it on the ballot, the fight for it, demise, the fallout from it, are probably what people are going to think about when they think about 2012 in terms of food politics.
What do you think has yielded?
I think actually Pollan was wrong in that I don't think its failure means there's not a food movement. I think that, you know, political movements are all about defeat and reacting to defeat and strategizing and moving on from defeat. I always think about the civil rights movement and the books of Taylor Branch, who wrote, you know, really kind of deep in-depth histories of Martin Luther King and the civil rights struggle. And when we think back in the civil rights movement, I think we tend, with our American kind of triumphalism, to think about it as this sort of great success, that, you know, there was this series of boycotts, confrontations with police in the South and riots in the North, and the movement kept going, and through this there's this triumph. When you read Branch's book, which really kind of puts you into the moment, you see that many times in the movement, MLK was completely depressed, didn't know what to do next. He felt like he, you know, was on the wrong end of a series of defeats. And I think that we, as a people here in the United States, tend to lack patience and want instant results. And, you know, we've got this extremely powerful, entrenched food system that, you know, obviously makes billions of dollars in profit and invests a lot of that stash in lobbying and advertising and marketing, and it's an extremely difficult thing to reform. And I think that we need to take things like the Proposition 37 struggle as a learning experience. It was worth trying. And, you know, I think that the measure of it isn't whether it succeeded or failed, because it failed. I think the measure of it is how the movement reacts to it, what happens next. I think it, you know, it's actually a sign of political maturity that the movement tried to grab political power. It tried to grab power on a big political stage, which is California, which would have been very influential. And I think that it needs to maintain its ambition and keep moving in that direction.
So, Tom, when you were talking about the movement trying to grab power in Proposition 37, and we covered that pretty intensely here on Soundbites, all sides, we talked to everybody. And it seemed it was fraught with lots of different problems that really go to the heart of some of the gaps that exist between people who are in this quote-unquote food movement and the larger public.
Yeah.
You saw the NAACP, and I think this is significant, especially in terms of what you've been writing back and forth about the organic movement and what Mehmet Oz has been saying, which you've been writing about in your blog, that you saw the NAACP in California come out against Proposition 37, partially because it would raise money on poor and working people to buy their food. And that, I think, might have been all the money that was put in by Monsanto, General Mills, and the rest to defeat the referendum. But that particular line of reasoning and thinking with the general public, with people in general, does people hear that? Because that's what they worry about. You know, so I'll eat my frozen spinach. I don't care what's in it. I got to feed my family.
Yeah.
So and I think that is part of the gap. It's a huge piece to come over, whether it— Well, let me stop there. Let you go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with that. In the case of the California ballot initiative, the studies that the opposition to 37 were bringing up to document the claim that there was going to be this significant rise in food costs from it were industry-funded. And I think that in the end, it was pretty unlikely that this measure would have raised food prices significantly. I mean, you know, Americans pay a little bit more as a percentage of net disposable income for food than Europeans do. But, you know, Europe has had a labeling requirement for years for GMO foods. And the effect of that requirement has been that most companies avoid GMO foods and don't put them in stuff. And Europe does not have significantly higher food prices. Food prices didn't significantly rise because of it. And, you know, many of the countries in Europe have a much stronger safety net than we do, which I think is probably more important than whether or not we have labels on our food. So I think those arguments were specious. But I think the issue that you're bringing up is a very real one, and it's a long-standing one with the food movement. And I think that a lot of people in it for a long time emphasize that, you know, you have to pay more for your food, that we're not paying the full price for our food, that there's all these costs that are being, not marginalized, but costs that are being, you know, that are off the books of the food companies,
right,
and there aren't in the price tag, that are externalized, is the economic term, that you're not paying for when you buy a McDonald's hamburger. And I think that is a tough message for people, especially in a country like ours that has a pretty weak safety net, you know, compared to other Western economically powerful nations, that has a many decade history now at this point, you know, something like 30-year history of stagnant wages, to tell people you're gonna have trouble creating a popular movement by telling people they have to pay more for their food. And I think the answer to it is pretty clear, and it is, you see it in places like some of the really low income areas of Brooklyn or, the Bronx, and I'm pretty sure in Baltimore, although I haven't gone to check it out, in places like Chicago, Milwaukee, West Oakland. The answer to it is to create movements within neighborhoods around the idea of food sovereignty, to where people start questioning what it is that they're getting from these corporations, and start, you know, working on the ground to create alternatives. And and I think when you come at it from that perspective, and you know, I think that there's a guy, Brahma Mahdi, in Oakland, who you should have on the show sometime. He's a he's a great activist, and he's working in West Oakland to start a grocery store, a spinoff of the organization People's Grocery in Oakland. But there's an analogy to be made with the environmental movement. And as I'm sure you know, Mark, as the environmental movement was moving forward, it became clear that there was this juncture between, you know, most environmentalists and people who lived in communities that were on the wrong end of stuff like toxic waste dumps and
right,
power plants, things like that, that, you know, the environmental movement wasn't concerned with. They were worried about, you know, saving the whales or whatever. And from that dissatisfaction, the environmental justice movement grew forward and started to organize in communities like that. And it was communities organizing themselves without, you know, the lobbying power that you get when you have lots of money to end this discrimination. And it's an ongoing project, obviously. And I think that from the food movement, we've got something called the food justice movement. And to me, that is the key leading edge of the food movement. And that's really where we have to put our energy. Because, you know, I think it's all too easy to imagine a world, and I think we're actually living in a world, where if you make a certain income and you live in a certain city or a certain part of a city, then you've got an amazing food system. You've got a farmer's market that's got this amazing variety of quality food that you can afford. You've got the time and the skills and the sort of cultural capital to know how to cook that food. And you can, you know, you will see health gains from eating that food. And in your little bubble or pocket, it can seem like, hey, there's no problem with the food system. It's all right there. Everything's fine. And then, you know, in the same city across town, people are eating really low quality food from Walmart or from, you know, worse, from fast food joints, and getting sick. And so then you get two food systems. You get one food system for those sort of in the know and who've got the money to access it. And then you've got the food system for the other 98% of people, 97% of people. And if you believe, as I do, that our food system is taking us down into this ecological black hole, then that's simply not sufficient. And, you know, I don't care if I'm able to get great food that I can afford from the farmer's market, or if I live on a farm, which I do sometimes, I also have access to that food. That my individual experience really doesn't matter if the big movement of society is lurching in this direction of this damaging food system. So I see, as a commentator and participant and observer of the movement, movement, I see the real the critical energy being in this food justice movement, this movement to get where people in these communities are asking questions and developing alternatives to this dominant position. And, you know, it's anything but elitist. And, you know, Erica Schlosser, one of them considered to be kind of a mentor, you know, says that the real elitists are the CEOs and the shareholders and the people who profit from companies like McDonald's or Monsanto. They say that they're bringing cheap food to the masses, but what they're really doing is selling people very low quality food, making them sick.
So let me ask you this, Tom. This because I think this ties into some of the stuff that you've been writing about on your blog, and let me tie it in this way, because you've been writing a lot about pesticides,
yep.
and its effect on the environment and on waterways and on children and on our bodies and more.
Yep.
And there are here where I'm broadcasting from at the moment in Maryland. There are going to be two major reports coming out talking about pesticides in the water that they've done these studies on, and it'll become a battle in this state legislature. I'm sure some other state legislatures around the country as well, because of reports like that. And we're not talking about farms. There's all kinds of runoff from sewage plants. There's all kind of runoff from this massive development going on everywhere as well. But one of the things is that as we've had discussions on the show before, that many of the people that are directly affected by this on their day-to-day lives are the farmers who farm the land. They're who use the different kind of fertilizers and other things you need to grow the crops that they're growing or feed the chickens they're growing, and et cetera. And for the most part, most of these farmers have been on the land for three or four generations, sometimes for hundred years, sometimes for 200 or 300 years in areas like this. And it's their way of life. And this kind of farming is the only thing that allows them to stay on the land.
Yep.
And so two things. I mean, and sometimes I think when you also talk about food movements in this country, sometimes I think that those kind of the push often makes these farmers the enemy. When I would say they're not the enemy. They're not. They're trying to eat, survive, and live on the land.
Right.
This is a very difficult juncture, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point that often gets lost. And I think that a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the food movement, and, you know, specifically around crop subsidies, can fall into this. And I try to be careful to avoid this, but a lot of that rhetoric can tend to whip up this sort of anti-farmer sentiment and pit the food movement against farmers, which I think you're pointing out is absurd. And the way I would respond to that is that if you look at these economic forces that some of them that I write about all the time, like consolidation of food markets, where you get fewer and fewer companies. Say, you know, an example that's kind of important in Maryland: fewer and fewer companies dominating the processing of chicken. So if you're a poultry farmer in the Delmarva Peninsula, you've got, you know, one or two buyers for your product who probably have you on a contract that they dominate the terms of. And you know, you're sort of like, you become like this object of this, you know, giant corporate force that's way bigger than you. There's one or two of them and there's a bunch of you and they've got all the power. And so what I would like to point out is, first of all, there has been this mass movement off of farms in the United States, you know, in the last 70 years. And some of that is because people decided they didn't want to farm anymore and wanted to go move to the city and do something different. But another part of it was involuntary. There are thousands and thousands of people driven off farms by low prices for their goods. And that is those companies using their economic power to push prices to pay farmers down. It's those companies forcing farmers to scale up and invest more and more. And I think that if we can point this out and make this known and show people that this isn't a natural, this isn't just how things are. This isn't the nature of things. This is an economic situation that decisions have been made to put it in place. Policies have been made at the, you know, the national and state level to prop it up. And it exists because of those reasons, and it could be changed for those same reasons, then I think that we can get farmers and the movement together again. And in fact, there are some really great established farm groups like the National Family Farmer Coalition that is really, really good at bringing these issues up. And, you know, the other thing is that I think that the pesticide companies are always into downplaying the dangers of these chemicals that they sell to farmers. And they convince farmers that there's no problem with them. Study after study is showing that, at the farmer level, in areas where these chemicals are used a lot, in the drinking water, whether you live on a farm or not, you're getting exposed to these chemicals, and the news is not good. Cancer rates are higher, life expectancies are lower, things like that. And I think all of these, you know, making these analyses and doing it in a way that's not aggressively anti-farmer, but that is inclusive of farmers, is critical.
That was Tom Philpott, food and agricultural blogger for Mother Jones Magazine. And we'll take a very short break, but don't go away, because when we come back, we'll hear more from Tom Philpott, and then check back with Sophia Maravel of Brickyard Educational Farm about their struggle to keep their farm in the face of planned development. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and this is Soundbites on Delmarva. Let's get right back to our conversation with Mother Jones food and agricultural blogger Tom Philpott, who shared some insight about a topic he's been writing about a lot, pesticides. So I want to kind of focus in more on where you left off and what you've been writing about pesticides, because this has become something that you clearly have done a lot of research in, become very passionate about, and laying on the table for people to begin to consider about what pesticides could be doing to us. So just talk about that a bit about that. I mean, everything you've written, from side order of a toxic blue algae with your burger to the pediatric issues to what's happening to things that live in the water and to us. Just give us an overview of things you've been working on.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on here. But, you know, what it basically is that what we put on the land ultimately is going to end up in the water. And it's going to end up in some trace in the food, and it's going to enter our bodies. And what the EPA does, you know, how the EPA regulates these things. But let's take pesticides first. What the EPA does is that they regulate them, you know, based on toxicity studies, and it must be said, often completely relying on studies put forward by the companies themselves or funded by the companies themselves. And they regulate them, you know, they create a tolerance level, say, for a pesticide residue on a piece of fruit, based on an individual pesticide. And you know, we can argue about whether the tolerance levels are too high or too low. One thing they don't do is they don't analyze them or regulate them based on how they actually come into our bodies, which is in multiple pesticides. When you look at USDA, so the USDA keeps pesticide residue data. They buy a basket of crops, of fruit and vegetables, produce in the supermarkets from, you know, retail supermarkets every year, and test them for residues. And, you know, routinely, what they say is it's no big deal because almost all the residues are at levels below the EPA's tolerance level. But what they don't do is they don't analyze how these pesticides act in combination, which is important because there's evidence that there's a cocktail effect that, you know, pesticide A and pesticide B in isolation at these low levels don't do very much, but they do other things when they're combined together, even at low levels. That's one thing. Another thing is the emerging science of science around endocrine disruption, and that is that some chemicals behave differently and more with more damage at very low levels, and they create subtle effects in hormones in people, which are especially important and damaging for, say, young mothers or pregnant women or small children. And so endocrine disruption is not something that is well accounted for by the EPA in their pesticide levels. And so what we're getting is exposure to all of these different pesticides at very low levels that isn't very well regulated. One thing that happens over and over again is when you study pesticide residue levels on organic produce, it's always way, way lower than conventional produce. And it's the residues that are on there are of way less toxic substances. So if you can afford to feed your kids organic vegetables, then you're not giving them that load. And so you get this inequality built into the food system. And to me, what makes me so angry about it is if you're a low-income parent, you are told, feed your kids fruits and vegetables, stay away from processed foods. And to do that, you're overcoming all this marketing and advertising and convenience of processed foods. And you're stressing, fruits and vegetables. And in doing that, the government's not properly regulating them for pesticide residues, and they're letting those people down. And that, that's my point. I don't want to make it an individual choice, like you're wrong if you feed your kids conventionally grown vegetables. What I want is proper regulation of all fruits and vegetables, and so this problem of pesticide residues is not happening at all.
Tom Philpott, it's always great to talk to you. We learned a great deal. We look forward to doing this again very soon, right after New Year. Tom Philpott is food and ag blogger at Mother Jones. He's the co-founder of Maverick Farms, a center for sustainable food education in Valley Crucis, North Carolina. He was formerly a columnist and editor for the online environmental site Grist, and his work on food policy has appeared in Newsweek, Gastronomica, and The Guardian. And Tom, Happy New Year, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mark.
We turn now to a topic we've been covering on Soundbites since September, that of an organic farm and seed-saving operation that's in jeopardy of losing its land after over 30 years. We'll check back in with Sophia Maravel, founder of Brickyard Educational Farm and daughter of Nick Maravel, an organic farmer and seed-saver in Montgomery County, Maryland, who we've talked to many times before on this program.
A lot of people are understanding this issue as a private farmer versus public soccer fields, when in reality, the farmer is endorsing a independent nonprofit educational farm entity to continue on the land versus non-public MSI member playing only soccerplex. So we're just trying to make that clear.
Let's take a step backwards so we can kind of pick up some ground. Some new listeners may not even know what we're talking about. Tell a bit about the history of what you just said of Nick's Organic Farm. Lay that out for us again very quickly so people understand what we're talking from.
This farm that my father has farmed for the past 32 years organically is owned by the school board. The school board bought this land about 60 years ago. My father has been stewarding it for the past 32 years. It's an unbuilt middle school site. About spring of 2011, the school board did not renew my father's lease and instead leased it to Montgomery County behind closed doors, who then leased it to MSI, Montgomery Soccer Incorporated. That lease has not gone through because it is now tied up in the court. The validity of that lease, that initial lease from the school board to the county, is still in question. What the community and myself are proposing is to appropriate this public school board land for educational purposes while preserving the very fertile soil that my father has built up for the past 32 years. So we've developed a proposal called Brickyard Educational Farm, which is a project of a nonprofit that we actually piloted this past season and summer, and are proposing to lease this land from the school board as an nonprofit agro-educational entity for the public school students of Montgomery County.
So is Nick's Organic Farm no longer? I mean, is that entity going to be...
Currently, Nick's father does not have a lease on the land, and he is not reapplying for a lease on the land. Brickyard Educational Farm is.
What about the effort to create, grow, preserve, and distribute organic non-GMO seeds?
Included in the Brickyard Educational Farm proposal is a farm-to-school program for students in Montgomery County, as well as 7 acres allocated towards preserving and maintaining these very rare heirloom varieties of corn and soybean seeds that my father has been saving the past 30 years. And with that would be a apprenticeship program that would help train the next generation of farmers, not only how to farm organically, but specifically how to be seed-saving farmers. And those are a very rare profession these days. Only 1-2% of all farmers are organic farmers, and even fewer are actually seed-saving farmers, because you need a totally different skill set and knowledge base to save seeds to then sell to other people to farm. It's different than growing food that you eat directly.
This is interesting. So in that, this has kind of changed the kind of tenor of the discussion. I mean, originally this was a farm that your father farmed that you all grew up on. That was an organic farm that he had a CSA and sold to a large community of people who bought the organic produce that he grew, correct?
Originally, yeah, back about probably 20 years ago, and then he shifted more towards seed saving. Yeah.
So where is it now?
The school board leased it to Montgomery County, and then the Montgomery County subleased it to MSI, or tried to. Right now, the county doesn't even have a lease from the school board, and my father doesn't have a lease either, even though he is allowed on the land to tend the crop. So we're still on the land until a hearing on February 8th, which will rule on the original lease from the school board to the county, whether or not that is legal and valid.
And who's hearing that?
Judge Greenberg is hearing that in the Rockville Circuit Court on February 8th at 9 a.m., I believe.
So this could still be wanting its way through the courts for a while.
Yes. This is a follow-up to the August 14th court hearing that issued a stay on the property, which temporarily voided and potentially permanently voided the school board's original lease to the county, and therefore voided our lease. We were subleasing from the county, and also would void the future lease of the sub-counties of the county sublease to the Montgomery Soccer Incorporated MSI.
So what's happening to the development of and saving of this organic seed that your father, Nick, has been working on for a long time?
The seeds will hopefully continue to be preserved through the Brickyard Educational Farm proposal. If the school board chooses not to lease it to Brickyard Educational Farm, then those seeds very well may go extinct. There are multiple varieties of vegetable varieties that are going extinct every day, just like endangered animals that people don't even know exist. And that's a problem because we need to preserve the remaining dwindling genetic biodiversity of our seed stock if we want to ensure national food security and seed sovereignty.
Many people hearing this again are probably thinking, why is this important? I mean, what's the real kind of, both in terms of agriculture and the politics of the seeds as you see it?
I see it, you know, if we learn from history, looking at the Irish potato famine, that happened because in Ireland there was really only one variety of potato that was planted. And when a disease came through that affected that one variety, it's like putting all of your eggs in one basket. Literally, all of the potatoes died. Now, potatoes originally come from Peru. There are hundreds of varieties of potatoes. Some are pink and long and look like they have scales on them. Some are purple. And you have natural diversity in nature, and that is nature's way of being resilient against pests or diseases that might come along. And so if in Ireland they'd planted maybe, you know, even 30 varieties of potatoes, the chances are that some of those varieties would have been resistant to whatever had attacked the one variety that everyone had planted. And so that's kind of where we need to think about being smart and being resilient to what may lie ahead in our future in terms of our nation's food supply. So if we want to produce food for our country, we have to not rely on maybe three or four varieties of, you know, corn and soy, which is what we're doing right now in the United States, a lot of which are genetically modified. We have to maintain our original seeds, and we can't let the original seeds, that purity of seed, who knows what the use will be in the future of that genetic biodiversity, get contaminated by genetically modified pollen. We have to make sure that that purity remains, and we have to keep that alive if we want to feed ourselves in the future.
And what about this support base you all have built? When it was saying it was saving Nick's farm, so that has changed. Is that correct?
Yeah, the supporters of the Save Nick's Farm campaign the Save Nick's Farm campaign has evolved into the Save the Soil campaign, which is now supporting Brickyard Educational Farm, and we have 50,000 petition signatures online through Care2 and Change.org. We have a personal letter from Governor Martin O'Malley endorsing this agro-educational vision for the state. We have a personal letter of endorsement from Wendell Berry, whom I met after he spoke at the Kennedy Center for the Jefferson Lecture this past spring. We have about 24 dozen organizations, nonprofits, civic local organizations, environmental groups, locally, regionally, and nationally, who signed on to a letter of support for this agricultural educational vision. And we also have a letter from our county council that says, let's take a step back and look at how this process has been handled, and let's put this back on the table in order to consider alternative solutions and proposals such as Brickyard Educational Farm. So we have a lot of support from all over on many levels, and this campaign has been going on for, you know, the Save Nick's Farm campaign started about a year and a half ago, and it's transitioned into the Save the Soil campaign now, and it's continuing to build. So we're really making this into a national issue at this point, and I think the trend of environmental, outdoor, farm-based education and nutrition and healthy eating and sustainable agriculture is really behind us on this one.
So Sophia Maravel, tell us again how people can connect to what you're doing, webpage or whatever you have.
Yeah, you can check us out online and get involved at www.savethissoil.org or at www.brickyardeducationalfarm.org.
That was Sophia Maravel, founder of Brickyard Educational Farm in Montgomery County, Maryland. Acclaimed author, environmental journalist, who was also the Baltimore Sun's environmental columnist for decades, and Delmarva native, Tom Horton, has been part of Soundbites since its inception. Tom joins us now to share what he sees as the most important stories about the environment and farming in 2012, and give us some predictions of what he thinks the coming year might bring.
You know, I guess we should start with we talked about this. This was definitely the biggest news, agriculture, environment, about Delmarva in the last year was the Purdue Hudson Waterkeepers trial, where the environmental group sued Purdue and a family farm, the Hudsons, over pollution by chicken manure, and of course the verdict was not guilty, and pretty much a slam dunk for the agricultural side, and you know, that case had huge nationwide implications, being watched closely. If it had gone the other way, it would have by far been the most important thing to have happened this year to agriculture and the environment. It would have changed the way we do business regarding spreading manure across farmland. it was big news, it sort of preserves the status quo. Except really, Mark, I think the status quo on manure and water quality is changing. We know, no matter how this verdict went, that we're putting too much manure on a lot of farmlands down here. We know it is polluting the rivers, that many of these shore rivers will never meet water quality standards unless we change some of these manure spreading practices, and this is poultry manure. We have to stop using the manure like we're using it in many areas. The soils are saturated with pollutants from it, like phosphorus, and that's pretty clear. You know, the Maryland Agriculture Department, too, has been tweaking the way it regulates the amount of manure you can put on a field. My sense at this point is that they still aren't where they need to be. In fact, that's a pretty strong sense. They're better, going to be better than they were in the past, but people in the University of Maryland College of Agriculture, the agricultural scientists there, and the Maryland Department of Agriculture, I don't think can yet bring themselves to bite the bullet and start treating poultry litter as a water quality issue rather than an issue of we've got to make sure the farmer has some way to dispose of this. You know, that's where the work is, and it's going to happen, but it's happening way slower than it should be.
What about the other? You mentioned you thought of four or five other things that really were, you thought, really important stories in the last year. What were they?
Well, you know, this is an ongoing story, but it's just begun to dawn on a lot of us in the last year or two that these cover crops that were basically invented in Maryland 20 years ago, the winter crops that farmers put on to suck pollution out of the soil, stuff that's left over after they harvest the crops, that these things are achieving real gains, keeping huge amounts of pollution out of the bay. And, you know, it's not the cheapest program. The state helps farmers with it, but it's a success. We talk a lot. Agriculture is the biggest source of bay pollution, and not surprisingly, because it's by far the biggest human use of the bay's watershed, tens of millions of acres. So it's going to be the biggest source of pollution, not an individual farmer so much. But these cover crops really are a real gain, and they're here, and they're not going away. Now, having said that, that's in Maryland. Pennsylvania and Virginia are not anywhere near where we are. But that's something that, you know, we've been writing about for years, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, we're doing it. We're doing it big time across hundreds of thousands of acres. And so that's not sexy news, but it's real important. Another thing that is, just to me, the if you wanted to do a case study of how not to do a national energy policy, it would be this ongoing egregious federal subsidy to farmers to grow corn to make ethanol, which gives back just a little more energy than you put into to produce it. It pumps up the price of corn, which I would like if I were growing corn. But it's a terrible energy policy, and it results in putting probably an unnaturally high number of acres all over the country, but certainly also in the Bay watershed, in the most polluting kind of agriculture, which is row cropping things like corn. And that's the hardest, among the hardest to control sources of agricultural pollution, because it uses a lot of fertilizer. The corn doesn't take it all up. So, you know, I would never have believed 5 years ago that this ethanol strategy would not have collapsed. It's a wonderful case of politics trumping every other consideration, science, environment, common sense. So, you know, that's something we continue to be impacted by, and it's a federal-level thing. I think I think maybe some of the biggest things happening right now with farmers potentially is this move to try and meet EPA's new tougher water quality standards for the bay and its rivers through nutrient trading. And this is sort of like you're a big city sewage treatment plant and you're bumping up against the limits of growth and technology, and taking more pollution out of your sewage treatment plant is ungodly expensive. So the concept is you shovel a fraction of the money you would otherwise have spent, but still a lot of money, to a bunch of farmers in your region who can clean up the same or more amount of pollution to the bay a lot cheaper than you can. So nutrient trading, it's a great concept. A lot of people are trying to figure out how to make it work. It could potentially open up large reserves of cash to farmers to go beyond what would otherwise be economic for them. A little bit tough to see it working as well as its champions think. There are a lot of problems in how do you verify it, how do you equate what a sewage treatment plant does, which you can measure to the ounce, with what happens across millions of acres of farmland with thousands of farmers. But it is the way EPA and the states have said they're going to meet some of their biggest pollution challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it becomes a tool or the tool, hard to say right now. I'm personally a little bit skeptical, but I also feel that we got to try every tool at our disposal. But we've got to be able to verify stuff. We can't just shovel a lot of money at things that we aren't able to monitor, that we have to kind of take on faith that they may be working. So nutrient trading, another unsexy issue, but hugely important, whether it works or not, to the future of the Chesapeake Bay. And that's something you'll hear more and more about over the next year or two or three. There is a lawsuit trying to overturn the use of this strategy. There's also a lawsuit backing up a little by the American Farm Bureau and other interests that is challenging the whole Chesapeake Bay cleanup. So, you know, plenty of activity going on in the courts right now that could have big repercussions.
Tom Horton, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I really love that you are part of Soundbites on Delmarva. Look forward to doing a lot more work with you in the coming year, and Happy New Year to you and everyone out there.
You too, Mark.
I'd like to thank all of our guests today. Tom Horton, author, environmental journalist, who was the Baltimore Sun's environmental columnist for decades. Tom Philpott, food ag blogger for Mother Jones. And Sophia Marivelle of Brickyard Educational Farm. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. And for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.